Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 29th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how flowers maximize their reproductive potential, a molecular marker of neurological status, and the urban landscape of the Amazon River Basin prior to European contact in 1492. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The sweet smell of flowers and the nectar they provide are much more than a reward for the pollinators that visit them. In a paper in this week's Science, Ian Baldwin and colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology report that the desert tobacco flower has a complex blend of chemicals that attract some species, repel others, and still serve the pollinators, but keep them from lingering very long. Baldwin says understanding the signals that plants use to manipulate pollinator behavior is critical in order to maintain the agricultural productivity that we have become accustomed to. I spoke with Baldwin en route to his team's field station in the Great Basin Desert in Utah.
It's really the first attempt to use the tools of molecular biology in a native plant system to understand how it is that plants solve a really important dilemma with regard to sex. Because plants want to have sex just like all other organisms. They want to have the benefit of outcrossing, but they can't move, and they've got to vector their gametes through a sort of a postal service, right, through pollinators. And how to manipulate pollinators is a tricky thing because you have to make yourself attractive. And making yourself attractive, of course, makes you attractive to things that don't just want to pollinate, but also eat you and drink your nectar and take the reward that you're supposed to give to the ones that are actually going to vector your pollen to the next plant. So plants have solved this problem by having a very complex array of chemicals, both in their floral sense as well as in their nectar. And what we do in this paper is dissect the various constituents that are in floral sense and in nectar and describe how those chemicals manipulate pollinator behavior so as to maximize outcrossing rates in plants.
How did your team go about testing whether just changes in the smell of flowers would affect pollinators?
So the way we went about it was we're working with a native tobacco plant that has a rich set of ecological interactions, including ones with different pollinators, has a whole series of different pollinators that come and visit it, produces a white flower that blooms at night, that begins to scent at night. And so the first step that we had to do was to figure out what the genetic basis of those floral scents were. And once we got to the bottom of that, figured out what genes were involved, we were able to then produce plants that were silenced in the production of those floral scents so that we could have plants that were basically scentless, and then created constructs that had various scents manipulated, particularly this one floral scent called benzyl acetone and a constituent in the nectar, which is a toxin, a nicotine molecule. And then with those plants that were silenced in the production of those secondary metabolites, we planted them out into a field station back into the plant's natural habitat and looked at what happened with regard to pollinator visits and gene flow, both from the standpoint of from one plant to another.
Before we get to that, why did you and your team choose this particular plant, this tobacco plant? Was it because it had this toxin, this nicotine?
That's one of the reasons, but it really is the sort of the founding principle of my department in the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology. We wanted to have a plant that has a rich suite of ecologic interactions, and I've been working on this plant for about 20 years, so I knew a lot about its ecology. It is a plant that chases fires in the Great Basin Desert. It comes in for 2 years after a fire has burnt up the habitat, and it does so by having a seed that is long-lived, lives in the seed bank, and then it germinates in response to the factors in wood smoke. And for the past 16 years we've been working on this plant. We've been putting molecular tools into this plant to study ecologic interactions. And now we're moving on to pollination systems.
So what happened when you made these transformed plants available to the birds and insects, the pollinators that typically visit them?
We found some very interesting changes in not only who was visiting them, but how the plants were utilized by the floral visitors. And we did that by measuring not only the visitors on video, we had video cameras running at night times, but we also measured the quantity of nectar that was left in the morning time, so the amount of nectar that remained after a night of having the flowers open. And one of the things we learned was that we came up with the explanation for why it is these plants put a poison, namely nicotine, into their nectar. And that was a really interesting mystery that we managed to solve.
Why do they do that?
Well, they do it actually for several reasons, but primarily with regard to the pollinators, they're enforcing modest drinking behavior. we found that if we had silenced the nicotine production in the plant, not only were those plants attacked by all sorts of herbivores that the plant normally isn't attacked by, so things that opportunistically lay their eggs and eat pollen grains were beginning to do that to the flowers, but pollinators came and drank all the nectar from these plants. And one of the things we've learned is that by having a little bit of nicotine in the nectar, the pollinators don't remove all the nectar. And as a consequence, there are more visitors to those flowers than would occur if the nectar wasn't a little bit poisonous.
Increasing the likelihood of outcrossing.
Exactly. And that's what we're able to show genetically, that those plants that produce nicotine in the nectar did have a greater diversity of fathers fathering their seed.
Were there any surprises or results that weren't clear in how the birds and insects reacted to the various transformed plant varieties?
Well, we had suspected that the floral scent, the benzyl acetone, would be an attractant. And indeed, it was. But what was surprising, too, was that this floral attractant, this thing that you could smell and obviously was attracted to hummingbirds and hawk moths, was also repellent to some of the nectar robbers. There's a group of xylocobid bees that come along, and they don't visit the top part of the flower where the pollination action occurs. They just simply puncture a hole with their beak into the side of the flower and drink the nectar, and thereby don't mediate any pollen flow transfer at all. They're simply just robbing the nectar. And we discovered that nicotine, of course, turns out to be a very good repellent against those xylocobid bees, but the benzyl acetone does also, so that when you remove both nicotine and benzyl acetone production, the xylocobid bees were particularly fond of robbing those flowers. So it's one of those things where you don't really understand function, ecological function, until you've done the manipulation and silence the genes and then look at what happens in the natural world.
Now, are these two the only two chemicals that affect how this flower smells or tastes?
Not at all. There is a fairly complex bouquet that's produced both from the headspace and in the nectar. But it turns out that of those, the most important and most abundantly produced attractant was this compound benzyl acetone, and the most important and most abundant repellent was the compound nicotine. And that's the reason why we focused on those, the two particular ones. But the flowers produce other constituents, and those other constituents indeed may have other functions and may modulate and tweak the interactions in a more subtle way, something we're going to have to work on in the future.
What about in other flowers? Are these two chemicals the primary chemicals, or are there other chemical combinations that are attractive and repellent to pollinators?
So most flowers will have different compounds, and some of those compounds will be the same, but in different blends of attractants and inhibitors. It's going to be pretty species-specific.
Is it possible that there might be some practical application to this in perhaps producing transgenic plants out there in the food line or something?
Absolutely. As you probably have heard about and you have talked about in other science podcasts, is that one of the big dilemmas is the decrease in pollinators for a lot of the fruit crops and vegetable crops that we rely on agriculturally. And we know almost nothing about those plant-insect interactions that mediate the pollinator interactions. And this is really one of the first studies that begins to dissect that in a highly rigorous way. And one of the unique things about this study was that we managed to design an experiment which met APHIS approval, APHIS, the Animal Plant Inspection Safety Organization. And we were able to do these experiments with natural pollinators in a natural setting, but did it in such a way that the transgene remained inside the experimental plot that we work with. And so we have lots of things happening in terms of native pollinators. We also have a lot of bad things happening to the Apis mellifera, which is responsible for pollinating a large portion of our fruit crops, the colony collapse syndrome. And so understanding what are the signals that plants use to manipulate pollinator behavior is absolutely essential for this, if we're going to be able to continue seeing the sort of agricultural productivity that we've been accustomed to in the past.
Well, Ian Baldwin, thank you very much.
Great.
Ian Baldwin is senior author of a paper on how flowers attract and repel pollinators in order to maximize their reproductive potential. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Also this week, how cancer spreads. Researchers have traditionally considered cancer spreading or metastasizing a late-stage event because the cancer cells must be equipped to survive the trip in the bloodstream and initiate malignant growth in other parts of the body. But in a paper published online by Science, Katrina Patsipanina and colleagues at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center report that cancer may metastasize earlier in the disease process as normal cells that remain dormant until cancer genes are turned on. Experimentally, the researchers manipulated normal mammary cells in a way that allowed them to turn on certain cancer genes at various times after having injected them into mice. These injected mammary cells were capable of traveling in the bloodstream to the lungs and surviving there for up to 16 weeks without expressing any of the cancer genes. And the cells did not begin growing aggressively in the lungs until those cancer genes were turned on. The results help refine the conception of how cancer progresses and suggest that each step in the metastatic process be re-examined. Read more about it online at www.scienceexpress.org. Amyloid beta peptides are a major component of the insoluble plaques found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. Soluble forms of these peptides are found in the interstitial brain fluid that bathes your brain. But the actions and regulation of this peptide are not well understood. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, David Brody and colleagues have measured the levels of amyloid beta peptides and found that they correlate with how well a person is doing after suffering brain injury. The results suggest a new means to monitor people in intensive care, as well as monitor the effects of drugs that target amyloid beta peptides in treating Alzheimer's and other brain disorders. I spoke with Brody from his office at Washington University in St. Louis.
We've measured a peptide called amyloid beta in the human brain using microdialysis for the first time. We measured this peptide in traumatic brain injury patients and ruptured intracranial aneurysm patients who were in the intensive care unit. And the reason we were interested in this study is because amyloid beta plays a critical role in the development of Alzheimer's disease. And so in embarking on this study, we were interested in understanding the dynamics of how amyloid beta levels change in the brains of people that have had severe brain injuries, like traumatic brain injury, and hoping to get some insight into why that increases their long-term risk of Alzheimer's disease.
So none of the patients you studied had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia?
None of them had Alzheimer's or dementia, that's right. They were generally healthy before they had an acute severe brain injury.
So is this a normal component of the brain fluid?
It is. Amyloid beta is normally present in the cerebrospinal fluid, and it's generally believed that it was a normal component of the brain extracellular fluid, but this is the first time that that has been directly demonstrated.
How does that role for amyloid beta peptide differ in Alzheimer's patients from what you and your team studied?
Well, in Alzheimer's patients, amyloid beta is the primary component of the plaques that are a pathological hallmark of the disease. Our patients are not likely to have had plaques. They didn't have Alzheimer's disease, and most of them were quite young. This peptide in our patients was freely soluble, not deposited into the insoluble plaques that characterize Alzheimer's disease. The relationship is not clear between the soluble amyloid beta that is present in the extracellular space of the human brain and the plaques that characterize Alzheimer's disease. This technique of microdialysis is very useful for studying those extracellular soluble amyloid beta dynamics. And this was a place that we could start in our investigations.
So what did your team find in looking at these patients?
We found that amyloid beta levels rose as patients' neurological status improved and fell as sometimes their neurological status worsened, as sometimes occurs at these seriously injured patients while they're in the intensive care unit. This was an interesting finding because in previous studies in mice, the brain's neuronal and synaptic activity has been found to be directly related to the concentration of amyloid beta in the extracellular space, as measured by microdialysis. So while we did not directly measure neuronal activity or synaptic activity in our patients, we think the most likely reason that amyloid beta levels rose as patients' neurological status improved is because the synaptic activity in their brains increased concomitantly with their improvement in the neurological status. As they recovered from their injury, as they required less sedating medications in the intensive care unit, and as other aspects of their cerebral physiology improved, it is likely that their synaptic activity also improved. And if what was found in mice is also true in humans, that would also lead to higher levels of the amyloid beta peptide. And that is, in fact, exactly what we measured.
I understand there might be several forms of these amyloid beta peptides. Are they all the same?
So most of our data, we measured total amyloid beta. We used a measurement technique called enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or ELISA, that measures total soluble amyloid beta in the brain. But amyloid beta comes in several forms. And we also measured separately the 42 amino acid form and the 40 amino acid form.
What's characteristic of those? Why those in particular?
Well, the 42 amino acid form is of particular interest because it is the most likely to form the insoluble clumps that characterize the plaques in Alzheimer's disease. And it also appears to be most likely to aggregate into the small assemblies that appear to be especially toxic to brain cells and especially interfere with synaptic function. Now, we did not directly measure these small assemblies, nor did we look directly at plaques, but we did measure the 42 amino acid forms separately. And all of the dynamics that we see in total A-beta appear to be reflected in the dynamics of amyloid beta 1 through 42 as well. Specifically, what we found was that there was a very strong correlation between amyloid beta 1 through 42 and total amyloid beta, that whenever amyloid beta total went up, amyloid beta 1 to 42 went up, and when amyloid beta total went down, amyloid beta 1 to 42 went down.
So at this point, is there any evidence from the study that people with these brain injuries might later develop Alzheimer's as a result of the brain injury?
This study does not settle that question at all. There's still a lot of work that we need to do before that question will be settled. Microdialysis, the technique we used, only measures extracellular amyloid beta. We have not measured amyloid beta inside of cells, which could be playing a pathophysiological role, nor have we measured these small soluble aggregates of amyloid beta, which some call oligomers, which could potentially play a pathophysiological role. And finally, at very, very early times after brain injury, if there was a rapid elevation of amyloid beta, we would not have seen it because our microdialysis typically started between 12 and 24 hours after brain injury, not in the very, very early times after brain injury. So this study really represents just the beginning.
How might others then apply this knowledge that you and your team have gathered about amyloid beta peptide levels?
Well, I think a lot more work will clearly need to be done before we have a clinical application of this. But one possibility is that because amyloid beta does appear to correlate well with neurological status, that it could be used as a marker of neurological status at times when it's difficult to assess the patients otherwise. And so it might be helpful in intensive care unit monitoring. This is a potential application that our senior author, Dr. Holtzman, finds particularly compelling. Another possibility is that microdialysis in the future could be used as a method for monitoring the effects of drugs that target amyloid beta. But for right now, clearly a lot of further work needs to be done. We've just scratched the surface of the interesting questions that can be addressed involving the pathophysiology of the human brain using this technique.
David Brody, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate the call.
David Brody is lead author of a paper on the correlation between amyloid beta dynamics and the neurological status in the human brain. Read the paper in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
The Amazon River Basin was a very different place before Europeans arrived some 500 years ago, spreading disease and wiping out a major proportion of the native population. Now, new research suggests that large, organized societies once lived and farmed the Amazon River Basin and built enormous earthenworks, shaped like circles, diamonds, hexagons, and interlocking rectangles. Science contributing correspondent Charles Mann traveled to Bolivia and writes about researchers who are tracing the ancient Amazonian past. I spoke with Mann from his home in Massachusetts.
For a long time, up until quite recently, archaeologists, geographers, ecologists, and other researchers thought it was almost physically impossible for there to be large-scale civilizations in the Amazon. And much to their surprise, over the past few years, evidence has emerged that not only were there large-scale civilizations in the Amazon, large-scale societies, but that they covered huge swaths of it and that they transformed their environments.
Is there some reason why these discoveries of ancient Amazonian civilizations are only coming out now?
Well, part of it was the belief that they simply couldn't exist. And the reason that researchers believe that they couldn't exist is that the physical conditions of the Amazon would seem to preclude it. And by that I mean that the Amazon is mainly covered with forest. And if you cut down the trees, the rain pounds down and washes away the nutrients in the soil, and the sun bakes whatever is left into something resembling brick. So you can't clear the canopy, as the scientists say, without ruining the soil. And if you ruin the soil, you can't have agriculture. And essentially, if you can't have agriculture, you can't have a large-scale society. And what researchers are discovering is that the original inhabitants of the Amazon were able, in fact, to build quite successful large-scale societies there, despite the fact that it should be impossible. You can't do it, but they did it anyway.
Is there something in particular that the ancient peoples did that allowed them to be in that area?
Well, they modified the landscape to make it better for them, and they did that in all kinds of different ways. For example, much of western Amazonia is eastern Bolivia, if you can imagine that on a map. And this is extremely low, swampy land that 4 or 5 months of the year is covered by water that runs off the Andes Mountains. And then it dries up and becomes quite arid for the rest of the year. And it would seem to be quite inhospitable. After all, nobody wants to live in knee-deep water for 4 or 5 months. Instead, native peoples constructed this archipelago of hundreds, if not thousands, of raised mounds, or islands you could call them, and linked them up by causeways. And then, because agriculture would normally be impossible in these conditions, they built huge areas of raised fields that lifted the crops above the water and provided better solar exposure. In other areas in the Amazon, they literally transformed the soil itself and made it into this long-lasting, fertile stuff that's called terra preta that seems to be able to resist the kind of physical abuse from the sun and the rain. So that there's a whole variety of different techniques that they used.
How old are these earthenworks?
Well, that's an excellent question because research is so new. The proper answer is we don't really know, but some of them seem to date back to something like 2,000 years before the Christian era.
Were they all built by the same culture, or are there multiple cultures involved?
Well, again, that's really an excellent question and one that researchers are not sure of, but it looks like the Western Amazon, far from being a kind of a cultural backwater, was in fact a cultural mixing ground, and you're looking at multiple different societies interacting over a long period of time.
Now, you mentioned the practical applications of these earthenworks. Are there any earthenworks out there that they haven't figured out the purpose of?
Absolutely. In a big band of sort of the northwestern Amazon in the Brazilian state of Acre are hundreds of what researchers call geoglyphs. And these are geometric shapes carved into the uplands, hundreds of meters on a side, circles and squares, some of them interlocking, rectangles, all kinds of different things. They're sort of vaguely reminiscent of the very famous Nazca lines on the coast of Peru. They're really quite spectacular to see from the air.
Before, they had been covered up by the forest.
Yes, and that's something that is in itself a fascinating thing. They really don't make any sense to make these very precise geometrical objects in the middle of a forest because you can't see them. And in fact, some of the areas are now covered over by forest. And I spent an afternoon with one of the researchers, Clark Erickson, with a machete hacking out the path so that we could try to map one of them. And it was just obvious that this had not been covered by forest when they were originally made. You know, a fascinating question is, what did the Amazon look like hundreds of years ago? It was not a complete virgin forest, as we so often imagine. It was much more patchy than we think. And there were clearly large-scale cleared areas in which these kind of things, geometric figures hundreds of meters wide, made sense.
Do researchers have any idea how big the civilizations would have had to have been in order to construct these massive earthenworks?
Well, it would depend on how fast they were constructed. Obviously, if you want to build a large thing, if you have many hands, it goes a lot faster. To some extent, further archaeological work will determine that, but they're already thinking that some of these areas are dealing with tens of thousands of people. In the furthest extent of this, in the south central Amazon, in another paper published by Science This Week, a wonderful paper written by Mike Heckenberger and his Brazilian colleagues, they've uncovered what he calls sort of semi-jokingly garden cities, these large-scale, very spatially extensive settlements. And these two that he has discovered that cover an area roughly the size of Belgium, he thinks had a population of greater than 50,000.
To that further archaeological work, with such enormous amounts of land to cover, how are researchers prioritizing which areas to concentrate on?
That's a very, very difficult question for them. And in fact, until quite recently, there's been so few of them, and the field has been so large that this question has kind of defeated them, because there's so many basic things that they have yet to answer. For example, Clark Erickson, who I mentioned, who is from the University of Pennsylvania, has been slowly, simply trying to map all the various phenomena in eastern Bolivia, and that's taken him years.
One machete hack at a time, as it were.
Yeah, one machete hack at a time. One of the kind of nice tools that's come online quite recently is Google Earth, and they've upped the quality of some of their images in that area, and this has allowed researchers to do surveys much faster. Before, they simply had to try to purchase satellite imagery, which is extremely expensive, and archaeology, of course, is always working within very limited budgets.
It sounds like this ongoing discovery is challenging and really perhaps even changing the view of Amazonian history.
Oh, I think so. In a sense, you could summarize the past view as saying that the Amazon had no history. One of the peoples that are sort of the poster children, if you like, for the South American lowlands is the Yanomami, despite the fact that they actually live mostly around the Orinoco, which is another huge river in South America. And the standard book on them is written by this researcher named Napoleon Chagnon. And if you read the wonderful deluxe edition with lots of great pictures, there's a preface by Edward O. Wilson, the famous Harvard biologist. And he talks about how the Yanomami live these kind of changeless lives, that they're essentially, we're looking at our ancestors from the Pleistocene who have lived in this way for thousands of years in this kind of timeless balance of nature. And now we're seeing that for much of the Amazon, that kind of picture is far too simple, that you're looking at people who are involved in large-scale societies and, you know, complicated historical processes that, you know, real histories that we're just beginning to unravel.
Does this discovery have any implications on tropical forest management today?
Well, first, you know, science is just there to tell you what happened. So here you're going on to the realm of interpretation, which is a little trickier. But having said that, I would argue that it could very possibly have some implications for today, because what you're looking at is people who lived in these tropical environments for thousands of years and who figured out extremely successful adaptations to them, ways of living there in large-scale societies that didn't wreck the land, that didn't ruin these fragile soils, and that left biodiversity intact. And it seems to me extremely implausible, just personally, that we would learn nothing from studying what they did.
Charles Mann, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science contributing correspondent Charles Mann on the ancient Amazonians. Read his article and a related research paper in this week's Science. Now, David Graham, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how to make a rubber hand come to life. We're going to solve the mystery of how wind turbines are killing bats the world over. And finally, we're going to find out how earthquakes may have given rise to some of the world's greatest ancient civilizations.
Well, let's start with getting a rubber hand to come to life. This isn't any kind of Frankenstein experiment, is it?
No, it's more of an illusion. Say I were to take your right hand, Rob, and hide it under a cloth. And instead, where your right hand usually is, I would put a rubber hand there, a rubber arm that looked like it was coming out of your body. And then I was to slowly stroke your real right hand and the rubber hand at the same time. And so you're just staring at the rubber hand being stroked, but you're feeling your real hand being stroked. After a few minutes, you're going to begin to get the sensation that this rubber hand is actually part of you, that the stroking you're feeling is actually in the rubber hand. So this is actually a bit of an old experiment. Psychologists have used this for a few years to study how the brain perceives the body's boundaries. In other words, if you're on a bicycle, how does the brain know where you stop and the bicycle begins? And this has been a real central question in neuroscience. How does the body tell what is part of us and what's not part of us?
So some new twist on an old experiment?
Well, the twist here is what happens to your real hand when you start to believe that a fake hand is your real hand? Does your body begin to forget about your real hand?
the way your mind does.
Exactly. And what the researchers did in this experiment was they repeated this rubber hand illusion on 10 volunteers, but this time they took the temperature of the hidden hand. And what they noticed is as people began to believe that the rubber hand was a real hand, the temperature of their real hand, the hidden hand, went down by an average of about 0.27 degrees Celsius. So the real hand was getting colder, almost as if the body was forgetting about it. And there was actually another piece of evidence that suggested the body was forgetting about the real hand. When the researchers tapped the real hand and the fake hand in different orders and at different speeds, the volunteers were more likely to suggest that the fake hand was the one being tapped first, even if it wasn't being tapped first. In other words, the volunteers were sort of forgetting when their real hand was being tapped by the experimenters, as if, again, their body had sort of begun to disown their real hand.
Well, that sounds pretty convincing, but what are we learning from a study like this?
Well, the cool thing about a study like this is that there's a lot of mystery about what happens with things like phantom limbs. You know, sometimes people will lose a foot or a leg and still feel sensation there. Or the opposite sometimes happens in stroke victims, where damage to part of the brain causes the mind to forget about an appendage that is still present. And so studies like this are important because they shed light on what might be happening in the brain when people have these types of traumas.
Well, from imagined dead appendages to real dead bats, I thought it was birds that were being wiped out by these wind turbines.
Well, Rob, it is. These wind turbines, which, you know, you see all over the country, they generate energy. They've got these huge blades that spin around and they're, you know, as big as 20 to 80 meters tall. And for decades, scientists have been finding dead birds near these turbines. And not hard to imagine why. You've got these spinning blades and birds flying through the air and you've got all these mangled birds at the bottom of a turbine. But what scientists have just started to notice recently is that there's actually a ton of dead bats along with those dead birds. And in some places, the dead bats outnumber dead birds by 4 to 1. And what's even more interesting is that these bats don't have the same type of external injuries that birds do. In fact, they don't seem to have any type of external injuries at all. So it's been this big mystery. How are the turbines killing these bats?
Because they're not actually striking the bats.
Right, because these bats don't have any external injuries, they're clearly not being killed by the blades. So something else about the turbine is killing them. The question is, what is it? And the answer comes from a graduate student in Canada who, as part of her master's thesis, went to some of the local wind turbines near her university and collected about 70 dead bats, cut them open, and tried to figure out what they were dying of. And what she found was that most of the bats she looked at showed signs of internal hemorrhaging. And that suggests that the bats died because of a sudden drop in air pressure. Now, if you think about wind turbines, as the blades cut through the air, they actually lower air pressure. And if bats get too close, they can experience this sudden drop in air pressure, much like a scuba diver might experience if he shoots to the surface too quickly. And this actually has a name. It's called pulmonary barotrauma. And basically what's happening is these bats are suffering from a sort of decompression sickness and they're dying, but they're not having any external injuries because all of the destruction is occurring in their lungs.
So the bats are quick enough to perhaps avoid the blades, but if they get too close, they still get in the low pressure area of the blades and that's what kills them.
Exactly.
So why aren't the birds dying this way?
Well, birds' lungs are not built like mammals' lungs. They're actually a lot more rigid, and so they're not as sensitive to these sudden changes in air pressure. So the birds are dying because they're hitting the blades, where the bats are dying because they are just roaming into these areas of low air pressure.
Well, now that they have this knowledge about how bats are dying from wind turbine farms, what are they going to do to try to prevent that?
Well, experts suggest a couple strategies. One is just to try to locate these wind turbines away from bat migration routes so that the bats aren't even getting close to these machines in the first place. Another strategy is to have companies turn these turbines off when the wind is slow, because bats tend to be more active in slower winds. And if you've got slower winds, you don't really need the turbine as much anyways. So if you turn them off, you may be posing less of a danger to the bats.
Well, from bats getting close to wind turbines to ancient civilizations getting close to earthquake zones, why would ancient peoples want to do that?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and it's an interesting theory proposed by a geologist who used to work for the U.S. Geological Survey, so he used to be actively involved in studying earthquakes. He's since retired, and since then he had been taking some classes at his local university about ancient civilizations, and the story goes that on a camping trip one night, he started to put two and two together, and he was looking at these maps of these ancient civilizations where they arose, civilizations like Rome and Corinth in Western Europe and Memphis and Jerusalem in the Middle East, and he started to notice a bit of a correlation. He said, hey, these civilizations seem to have started close to these tectonically active plate boundaries. And these boundaries are dangerous in a sense because they are likely to give rise to earthquakes and volcanoes and even tsunamis. So to confirm the theory, he took a map out and he looked at 13 ancient civilizations and plotted them, looked to see where they arose along these tectonic boundaries. And when he did the statistical analysis, he found that the vast majority of these civilizations didn't locate near these tectonic plates by random chance. It appears that they actually chose these areas for a specific reason.
Well, what other characteristic of earthquake zones, besides them being dangerous, might have led people there?
Well, it's a great question, and that's really where the science stops and the speculation starts in this study. And there's a bunch of different ideas about why these civilizations may have chosen to settle in these areas. One idea is that volcanic zones tend to have richer soils. So you could imagine people may have settled in areas where they had more success growing crops, for example. A related idea is that these zones often tend to have ample water supplies, so another big draw for civilizations. But perhaps the most interesting idea is a psychological explanation. And this idea goes like this, that maybe elders decided to settle on these sites because they were trying to teach the younger generation that, hey, life is tough. You've got to be prepared for things like earthquakes and volcanoes. And this is going to toughen you up. This is going to make us as a population, a stronger population, because we're dealing with all this adversity.
I am more persuaded by the soil and water idea.
Well, it does seem like a pretty far out theory, but at least one expert says it does have some weight. He calls it a sort of challenge and response theory to social development. But whatever the reason, the bottom line is that a little shaking up isn't necessarily a recipe for disaster.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for science now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about why flies are so hard to swat, how scientists are restoring hearing in mice and what the implications are for humans, and finally, what war has to do with the evolution of belligerence and bravery. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.com. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to an April 4th policy forum about personalized medicine. In that article, Sarah Katsanis and colleagues at Johns Hopkins Genetics and Public Policy Center argue for regulatory action to protect public health.
In the August 8th issue, John Urquhart writes in from the Department of Biopharmaceutical Sciences at the University of California, Washington Center to point out a missing factor from the dialogue about personalized medicine.
That missing factor is data to determine whether the patients are actually taking the drugs prescribed to them. Urquhart stresses that before we can draw conclusions about the effectiveness of drugs, we need detailed data for each patient's adherence to the recommended drug dosing regimen. To support his point, Urquhart refers to a study in which non-adherence accounted for about half of the non-responders to three-drug therapy for hypertension. In this example, once motivated to take the prescribed drugs, most patients became normotensive.
It is crucial to consider such findings, Urquhart urges, as we move forward with the rational implementation of personalized medicine. You can read the full letter in the August 8th issue.
Turning now to the August 22nd issue, Ray Guillory from Marmara University in Istanbul, Turkey, writes in support of the July 4th letter from RAF and colleagues on painful publishing.
RAF's letter raises a critical issue about peer review, Guillory writes. A young investigator who is challenged to undertake more experiments in order to get a paper published is not usually in a position to argue. To make sure additional work is justified, an editor asking for extra experiments should be able to answer the following questions.
Has the reviewer rigorously justified each suggested experiment? How much time and investment of resources, such as animals and materials, will likely be involved? Will the additional experiments strengthen a specific identified weakness of the manuscript rather than move the work on to the next stage or to one side? Does the reviewer have any conflicts of interest in making these requests? For example, would the reviewer's current research program benefit from information generated by the additional experiments?
By asking these questions, Guillory writes, the editor can intervene on behalf of the researcher, ensuring the best final product for publication.
Our final letter today, also from the August 22nd issue, is about improving scientific discourse. Seth Friedman from the University of Washington in Seattle writes with some tips to improve scientific discourse without furthering administrative oversight.
Friedman advises scientists to examine unspoken pressures. Too often, scientific acts are affected by influences other than those of pure science, such as conducting unblinded reviews, affirming popular literature conclusions despite contrary empirical evidence, meeting promotion requirements, sustaining unhealthy hierarchies in laboratories, fulfilling a priori grant data despite insufficient statistical power, and keeping one's constructed intellectual towers buffered from attack. Although these factors could be attributed to effectively playing the modern game of science, failure to consider their influence will guarantee their undesirable expression.
You can read the rest of Friedman's practices for modernizing scientific discourse in the August 22nd issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. And that wraps up the August 29th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.